Trade wars, when they happen, usually happen very slowly. And then, all at once. Word of the wise, that's all I'm saying. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. It is Tuesday, the 23rd of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Today's top story is brought to us by Section 201 of the Trade Act of 1974, to wit, Global Safeguard Investigations, Import Relief for Domestic Industries. That's the technical description of the tariffs President Trump has imposed on foreign-made washing machines and solar panels. China, as you might know, dominates the solar market, and trade tensions are, as you might also know, not zero between the United States and Beijing. The president promised today at the White House there is not going to be a trade war over this, and it turns out quite a few analysts agree, at least for now. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong starts us off.
The solar tariffs hit an industry in China that makes up a tiny fraction of its exports. So many analysts used adjectives like modest and benign.
So Xi Jinping's not going to be losing any sleep over this.
Andy Rothman is investment strategist at Matthews Asia. He thinks President Trump indeed wants to avoid a trade war because Beijing has lots of economic weapons. It could retaliate by, say, walling off U.S. soybeans.
Soybean farmers in the U.S. sell about a third of their product to China, and they all happen to be concentrated in Republican districts.
For now, the Chinese have just complained. But small barks could still lead to something. A new U.S. national security paper frames China as a global competitor. And there are more trade cases coming. One focuses on the Chinese stealing U.S. technology and ideas. And rumor has it, White House advisors want to get tough on Beijing. Attorney Claire Reed is an ex-U.S. trade negotiator.
If you look at the other actions that have been taken by the administration in 2017, and you look at the hardening rhetoric, I think you have to appreciate the tensions are growing.
Meantime, in Beijing, President Xi Jinping has his own economic nationalists to please. So if pushed, he may whack back. Cheng Li is with the Brookings Institution.
Xi Jinping is dealing with the Chinese business community reaction and also reaction from the Chinese political establishment. People sometimes think that he is too accommodating to the United States.
For now, each leader is choosing restraint. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Opening salvos of potential trade wars aside, those solar tariffs specifically happened because American companies said they couldn't compete against foreign products. And they've got a point. There are scarce few American solar manufacturing companies that have not gone bankrupt in the past couple of years. Now the ones that are left are getting the lift that only a 30% import duty can provide. But is that going to be enough? And oh, by the way, who is actually going to pay for those tariffs? Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
The prospect of tariffs has weighed on the industry for months. Now that they're decided, the petitioners are feeling
cautiously optimistic.
Tim Brightbill is with law firm Wiley Ryan, which represents SolarWorld, one of the two companies that asked for protection from cheap imports. They'd originally asked for much more, but Brightbill says the initial 30% import tax will help American solar manufacturers. SolarWorld is the largest panel maker in North America, and they've got plans.
They are scaling up their cell and module production, and they will produce as many solar panels as they can, and they will look to double their capacity in the next few years.
That would mean SolarWorld makes enough panels for a gigawatt of solar energy per year. But that's still just a fraction of the panels needed to meet U.S. demand. So, will tariffs help U.S. panel makers catch up quickly? Timothy Fox is with Clearview Energy Partners.
A 5x increase in domestic solar manufacturing seems unlikely. What seems more likely is a decline in solar deployment.
Fewer solar panels installed overall instead of more domestic ones bought. Abigail Hopper is CEO of the Solar Energy Industries Association. She estimates tariffs will decrease demand for solar by close to 20%. And as a result,
we think that in 2018 alone, about 23,000 Americans will lose their job.
Jobs like installers, electricians, salespeople, project designers. Hopper says as much as it hurts, it could have been much worse.
We appreciate the fact that the president really understood what was at risk here and didn't completely undercut our industry.
Yet also didn't completely incentivize U.S. solar manufacturing. While tariffs are in place, most panels will still come from beyond our borders. They'll just come at a higher price. Clearview's Timothy Fox estimates that will increase costs for a typical residential system by about $1,000, a lot more for major projects.
Utility, we're looking at more of about $2 to $3 million increase in a typical utility scale solar project.
Fox estimates the U.S. solar industry will pay about $1 billion in tariffs this year alone. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today looked a whole lot like yesterday, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a thing that happened in this economy 10 years ago yesterday. It was in some ways a warning of how bad the recession was going to get, and at the same time, a giveaway as to how little we actually knew about what was coming. January 22nd, 2008, early-ish in the slow-motion collapse of the American economy, the Federal Reserve announced, pretty much out of nowhere, that it was going to cut interest rates. A lot. Our year-long project on the financial crisis and its aftermath is called Divided Decade, how the past 10 years have changed this country and this economy. People have changed, of course, but so have some of our economic institutions. First among them, probably, the Fed. The Fed works hard, real hard, to be boring, to be as predictable as possible. So with that in mind, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes us back 10 years ago this week to when the Fed decided it was better to be bold.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke stared at the screen of his Bloomberg terminal on Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2008, a holiday, but not for him. He saw steep declines in Asia and Europe. It looked like fears of a recession in the U.S. could be taking hold in markets globally. We know now that things would get even worse in the coming months. But then?
We were struggling. Was this going to be a downturn like other downturns and you managed through it, or was it going to be more serious than that?
Thomas Hoenig was president of the Kansas City Fed at the time. He was also a voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee, which sets interest rate policy for the Fed. So Hoenig got a call that MLK Day. Bernanke wanted to hold an emergency video conference so the FOMC could approve a pretty dramatic cut in interest rates, 0.75%, triple the adjustment the Fed might make in calmer times. Hoenig was undecided.
I did not know how I would vote. I had anticipated that we would have a meeting in a few days, but I did notice the data coming in, and I did notice that there was evidence of weakness.
It wasn't just the stock market, which had lost 10% of its value in the first 3 weeks of the new year and was expected to lose another 5% the following day. Throughout the fall of 2007, there had been clear signs of distress in the housing market and a credit crunch among financial institutions. Earlier that January, Bank of America announced it was buying the failing subprime mortgage lender Countrywide. Just the week before, Merrill Lynch and Citigroup had taken a combined $35 billion in write-downs. The Fed staff had cut its growth forecast for 2008 to a wimpy 1%, though it wasn't yet predicting a recession. Some committee members immediately supported Bernanke's rate cut. Others, including Hoenig, struggled.
Were things deteriorating as badly as the data was perhaps previewing when you didn't actually have a long trend of that? Do you want to act too soon, which may actually encourage fear?
Cutting rates that much and doing it outside a regularly scheduled meeting might spook markets more than they already were. But acting now might reassure people, show the Fed was willing to do whatever it took to steady the economy. Bernanke favored action. He actually called his memoir of the crisis The Courage to Act. And the next day, the Fed announced its rate cut.
It's not like where were you when Kennedy was shot kind of thing. But as a historian, I can tell you that it was an extraordinary day.
Peter Conti Brown is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
I think this is an important canary in the coal mine to show exactly how the Fed is going to approach its own conception of its emergency authority. We see that the Bernanke Fed is truly going to do whatever it takes in order to sustain its economic mission.
In the coming months, that would mean loaning billions to J.P. Morgan Chase so it could buy Bear Stearns, and lending billions more to insurance giant AIG. It would mean cutting the federal funds rate to near zero and the start of multiple rounds of quantitative easing, buying trillions of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. All those actions had lasting consequences. For the economy, yes, but also for the Fed. Alan Blinder is an economist at Princeton.
The external image of the Fed changed enormously. Both the parts of the public that pay any attention to this and, importantly, the Congress were basically wowed by the Fed's power. Most of them had no idea that the Fed could do all the things it did.
Blinder thinks the Fed's response made the financial crisis significantly less severe than it might have otherwise been. But the timing of Fed actions, whether it should have done more or less, that's still debated. By 2009, the Fed had the lowest public approval ratings of federal agencies in a Gallup survey. Back in 2003, it was near the top. Here's Peter Conte Brown again.
I think one of the lessons, for better or worse, of the 2008 crisis and the Fed's decisions after the fact are that the Fed should tread lightly and should be extraordinarily deliberate when it deploys its extraordinary powers, because the political consequences are immediate.
He says separate from the economic lessons of the financial crisis, that political backlash might make the Fed less willing to flex its muscles in future crises the way it did 10 years ago. Reflecting back on that 2008 rate cut, Bernanke wrote in his memoir that he initially thought it was working, that maybe the Fed had things under control, and we'd reached the beginning of the end of the crisis. As it turned out, he'd come to understand we were only at the end of the beginning. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There are the big picture changes the financial crisis brought to this country and its institutions, but you got to remember the people, the way people's daily lives and their economic futures were turned upside down. We're going to be hearing from people all over the United States this year about what the Great Recession did to them. Today, a 27-year-old realtor named Diego Corzo.
I am a dreamer. I came here when I was 9 years old, and my parents did decide to overstay their visa at that time, and it didn't hit me that I was an undocumented immigrant until I turned 16 years old. In 2008, while the economy was crashing in Florida, I was also about to graduate high school. Even during the crash, as the crash was happening, my dad, he decided to open up a restaurant, and he didn't expect it to be that bad. And for a couple of months, the restaurant would sell less than $100 a day. My dad had to fire the dishwasher and had to fire the busboy and the waitress, and he had to do everything. He had to cook, wash the dishes, and also be out talking to the clients and making sure that everybody got served. My mom and my dad, they actually had to declare bankruptcy on their property. I see that there is a lot of ups and downs. So I would say that it has taught me to be ready to be aware that even though right now we've been going up in the economy for 8-10 years, that there's going to be a point where it's going to come down. As a realtor, you hear stories how there's been people that took advantage of when a crash does happen, and that they were able to buy properties at a very low price. So now I'm definitely putting myself in a position where if another crash happens, I'm going to take advantage of that opportunity. I want to be one of those people.
We've got pictures of Diego Corzo on our Instagram. It's at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, take a second, would you? Tell us how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag is How We Changed. It's all part of our year-long series called Divided Decade. Coming up.
It's a lot of stuff like Pop-Tarts or Lucky Charms or soda, you know, things that we're telling our children they shouldn't be eating.
Yeah, don't eat them, but by all means, do get those box tops, kids. First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, 26,210. The NASDAQ up 52 points, about 0.7%, 74.60. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, 0.2%, 28.39. Procter & Gamble down 3% today. Colgate Palmolive dulled about 0.6%. Kleenex maker Kimberly-Clark shined up 0.7% today on better-than-expected earnings. And also, by the by, announced a cost-cutting plan that would see thousands of layoffs and sale of some of its operations. Netflix beamed up 9.9% today. The streaming video company gained 8.3 million subscribers in the fourth quarter, handily beating analyst expectations. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell 2.61% is the number. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. With the government shutdown now behind us, President Trump is off to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland later this week. He's giving the closing speech at the annual gathering of the rich, famous, and powerful. And according to economic advisor Gary Cohn, today in the White House briefing room, he's doing a little selling as well.
The president is going to Davos to speak to world leaders about investing in the United States, moving businesses to the United States, hiring American workers, changing the direction of our economy to be one of the biggest and best and most efficient economies in the world.
That is the official line from our European desk in London. Marketplace's Stephen Beard explores some other possible motivations.
Davos seems to stand for everything that President Trump dislikes, a liberal global elite living high off the hog from the proceeds of free trade, while ordinary mortals struggle. So why on earth would he want to attend?
I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that Xi Jinping was there last year.
The Chinese president was the star turn at last year's forum, says Mike Jakeman of the Economist Intelligence Unit, and that rankles.
The fact that Xi Jinping was able to kind of seize the stage and position China as potentially a world leader was a bit of an affront to Trump, let's be honest.
Especially since Xi Jinping cast himself as the champion of free trade, global cooperation and multilateral decision-making. But come Friday, it'll be payback time. Trump will take centre stage and make the closing speech. What's he going to say? John Raines of IHS Market thinks it'll be a nuanced version of America First, but only slightly nuanced.
Really, we can all work together as far as a multilateral economic agenda, but only if it favors the United States.
Not quite the Davos creed. If Trump does speak bluntly, it may ruffle a few feathers among the 70 heads of state attending. But Raines believes he'll be well received by many of the 1900 CEOs and other plutocrats present.
I think that there's an opportunity here for many members of the Davos community to find many things in common with Donald Trump, vis-a-vis lowering taxes or just a general economic agenda that focuses on lowering government regulation.
Davos provides the world's best networking opportunity. Deals will be done. Central bankers will confer nervously over the difficult year ahead. But it'll be the glitziest shindig on the planet for the plutocrats. And that, says Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank, includes Donald Trump.
He's a rich guy, and he's comfortable with other rich guys. And I think that there is no place on earth where the rich are happier than congregating in Davos once a year.
Which may be why a US presidential appearance is a rarity. Hobnobbing with the global elite in a Swiss ski resort doesn't always play so well back home. At the European desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan is already in Davos, which makes this next item a tad awkward. B of A has eliminated free checking accounts for its customers who are only able to keep low balances. Those free basic accounts are getting harder and harder to find. Yet another hit, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports, for consumers who are already shut out of a lot of banking services.
45-year-old Vincent Aurelio was not happy when Bank of America informed him that his free checking account would no longer be free. The bank was going to start charging him $12 a month if he didn't meet certain requirements, like having a direct deposit of $250 or more, or keeping a daily balance of $1,500. So Aurelio canceled his account.
That minimum balance was just enough to tip me to the side of going ahead and changing institutions.
Aurelio opened up a free checking account at a local credit union in Houston. Now, Aurelio could afford to pay the extra Bank of America fees, but he didn't want to. Fees are harder for low-income bank customers who may not have a steady paycheck.
Income volatility is a huge issue right now.
Tasharia Jones heads the Office of Financial Empowerment for the City of St. Louis. She's afraid that as free checking disappears, low-income consumers will end up using a payday lender just to cash their checks.
And that person could charge as much as 10% or more of the amount of the check in order to cash it.
Bank of America said in an email that they offer an account with an upfront fee of about $5 a month with no overdraft protection. Rebecca Bornay of the Center for Responsible Lending says that can be a good deal for low-income customers.
It's a good option for people who are struggling to keep their account balances positive, and we'd like to see more of those.
And it never hurts to shop around. Small banks and credit unions can be more flexible about offering free checking. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Some of you out there might recognize this, or perhaps did it yourselves when you were younger. Your kids come to you, they ask for a pair of scissors, you ask why, and they say, I need to cut off a bunch of box tops and bring them into school. The Box Tops program, under the auspices of various big consumer products companies, has been around for more than 40 years, but perhaps not too much longer. Caitlin Dewey wrote the other day about the economics of those box top programs in the Washington Post. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
As I said in the introduction, I've been clipping these box tops forever, and now you tell me that maybe there are some hiccups with these things, yeah?
Yeah, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but a lot of public health advocates argue that these box top programs are actually not good for kids and that parents in school shouldn't participate if they have the option.
Okay. Before we get to the really bad news, lay out for me, and I suppose I should have thought of this, as I said, years ago when my kids first started saying, hey, Dad, can we clip these box tops? I clip a zillion box tops. The kids take them to school. Then what happens?
So there's usually a designated point person at the school. Sometimes it's someone from the Parent-Teacher Association. Sometimes it's a school administrator. And they collect all those box tops and they send them in to General Mills in the case of box tops. There are a couple other programs. Mm-hmm. Until recently, Campbell's had one as well. And then at the end of the year, usually the food company will write the school a check, which they can use any way they want. And a lot of schools use these for things like art supplies or gym equipment or, you know, playgrounds, things that aren't usually in their normal budgets.
What's the average payout, as it were?
So it's actually not a lot given how much work goes into the box top programs, both on the parents' end and on the school's end. It's generally about $750 a year.
Okay, but $750 buys a lot of pencils or playground stuff or whatever. What then is the problem with the box top programs?
Well, the problem is twofold. Number one, people who object to commercialization or commercialism in schools say that this is basically a marketing program. It's a form of advertising, and schools willingly participate in it, and they sort of foist these products onto impressionable children. So that's problem one. Problem two, on top of that, a lot of people say the products that are in a program like General Mills are not good for kids. It's a lot of stuff like Pop-Tarts or Lucky Charms or soda, you know, things that we're telling our children they shouldn't be eating, but then, you know, throwing them pizza parties if they bring enough product codes from these items into school.
Right. And one of the people you talked to for this article said a lot of the stuff that you get box tops for can't actually be sold in the schools.
That's right. Yeah. In 2016, the Department of Agriculture passed some marketing regulations. And they said, you know, if snacks and other products that usually appear in vending machines don't meet these minimum nutrition requirements, they can't appear in the schools, but they also can't be advertised in the schools. And a lot of those products are actually things that General Mills sells with the box tops label.
Yeah, and General Mills spokespeople told you it is emphatically not a brand marketing program, despite sort of indications to the contrary.
Yeah, all the companies are very insistent on this, and they say that they have all kinds of internal regulations and policies in place to make sure that they're only marketing healthy products to children or, in some cases, not marketing to children at all. But I think we have a lot of reason to sort of doubt those insistences. Yeah.
So should I, as a parent in good conscience, when my 10-year-old comes and says, hey, Dad, can we clip these box tops, should I say, well, no, sweetie, we can't? What do you think?
I would say yes. I am not a parent, but if I were, I would turn down the request for box tops. And you know what? If you're concerned about your school, you know, having some discretionary funds, there is an easy solution for you. Just buy store brand products, which are typically cheaper anyways and basically the same thing, and then donate your savings to the school, right? The school still gets the money, and you are not involving your children in a marketing program.
Cash is good. Caitlin Dewey, she writes for The Washington Post. Caitlin, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, Hawaii Governor David Ige gave his State of the State speech last night. Among the topics, of course, was that missile alert a couple of weeks ago that turned out to be not real. Ige said he knew within 2 minutes that the statewide alert that was sent out was a mistake, but that he wasn't able to tweet out that it was a false alarm for another 18 minutes because, and come on, you gotta feel for him on this one, he couldn't remember his Twitter password. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is basically flat today. NASDAQ up 52, about 0.7%. S&P 500 up 6, about 0.2% there. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote does video for us. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.